Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get started. And we're going to ask everybody, especially the St. Mary's kids, to take their seats. We all love being with each other, I know. But we have a program to get to. There's a wonderful reason that we're all here tonight, and it's about time that we all get to it. My name is Drew Russo. I am the executive director of the Lynn Museum Lynn Arts Organization, and I am thrilled to welcome all of you to the Lynn Museum this evening for the second in a series of conversations we're going to be doing, where we talk about the personal history that was shared with a legend that touched our community, touched, as was the case when we kicked this off in June, when Tom Costin, our former mayor and postmaster, came and had a wonderful evening where he talked about his relationship with the late President Kennedy. Tonight, we will talk about a legend in this community, somebody who played on our ball fields, who honored the uniform of St. Mary's, which is the alma mater, the proud alma mater of many of us in this room, but three of his teammates who were his close friends throughout his life. And I think that we're going to have a wonderful evening. Before we get it kicked off, I just want to talk about a couple of things that are going to be going on here at the museum over the next couple of weeks and at Lynn Arts next door. We're very proud to conserve the city's history in this building and to promote its emerging art scene in our galleries and Black Box Theater at 25 Exchange Street. I'd like to point out Peter Avanti, who is sitting in the back, or standing in the back. It is work. It's in the second floor gallery right now. A wonderful show called The Vision Place of Souls. His landscapes and Civil War artwork will be on display and is for sale until December 22nd, with a portion of the proceeds going to the Lynn Museum, Lynn Arts Organization. We also have an event coming up on September 15th, our annual History and Hops event, which is sponsored by Bentwater Brewing Company, the best local breweries around. History and beer, it's a great combination. We hope that you'll join us on Friday, September 15th. And if you check our website at www.lynnmuseum.org, you can learn about all the other things that are happening here through this fall and into the winter of 2018. I think, as we've seen in recent weeks with the excitement over the Beyond Walls Mural Festival, that downtown Lynn is the place to be right now. And I think that does deserve a round of applause. And we are proud to be a hub for arts and culture in our community. 25 years ago, I walked into St. Mary's for the first time as a student, and when it was going into my gym class, which was something that I should have failed and did very, very badly, as I played baseball very, very badly, but every day I walked in to the Tony Conigliaro Gymnasium, and I went home and I asked my dad who Tony C. was. And for my father, who was a young Red Sox fan, who in his early years endured the misery of a succession of pretty rough Red Sox seasons in the late 50s, early 60s, always came back to a local hero named Tony C, who he would listen to on the radio, watch on Channel 5, on Kurt Gowdy's broadcasts, and it gave him a lot of pride, and I think for many Red Sox fans at the time, instilled a sense of hope for the future. Which is a sense of hope that I think all of us Red Sox fans have been able to carry forth in the good times and in the bad. But then I learned about Tony Conigliaro's impact on my own alma mater as a St. Mary's graduate, and then learning about his teammates, some of whom I got a chance to meet when Marianne Rooney Hegan here in the front row used to bring me to alumni events. And I learned more about how Tony C., not only was he part of the St. Mary's fabric, but that St. Mary's was such an integral part of him. So it is so fitting that tonight's event sponsor, along with the Daily Item and Essex Media Group, is St. Mary's High School. And I'd like to welcome now a person who has been a friend, someone who's championed this event, recruited a lot of people to come tonight, and is such a great steward in our community, somebody who is carrying on that wonderful Catholic educational tradition of creating women and men for others, the head of school at St. Mary's, representing our event sponsor, Grace Cotter-Regan. Grace.
Thank Well, good evening. I want to thank you on behalf of St. Mary's for being here. Our board chair, Bill Mazakowski, should be in shortly, and our vice chair, Betty Toomey, is here. And one of our staff members, two of our staff members, our principal, Jim Ridley, and Jen Pierce from our advancement office. So I welcome you tonight on behalf of St. Mary's. And I am so excited to be with this esteemed group, who I have had the privilege to get to know over the years. And I want to talk about just a couple things. First of all, we have a magazine for you here tonight. It is the 135th year of St. Mary's, and that's a really exciting thing to celebrate. We do reference Tony C. in here as part of our timeline, and this is the legacy issue. So I hope you take a minute, if you haven't received the magazine, to read through it. There's some great stories, some great legacy, and I always call our little city block, that magical city block, that magical things happen in Lynn. And to be a part of the Lynn community has been really exciting for me, so I want to thank you. This year is also really exciting for us because we alternate. We have a varsity club and a Hall of Fame, and Ted actually was inducted this year into our Hall of Fame, so I want to congratulate Ted again. And we also have introduced a varsity club a number of years ago, because when I came to St. Mary's, we didn't have an athletic Hall of Fame. And so our athletic director, Jeff Newhall, said, wouldn't it be great to introduce an athletic Hall of Fame? So we did, and we call it the Varsity Club. And we will be inducting the third class this year. And two of our esteemed members here are inducted into the Hall of the Varsity Club, Frank and Tommy. And we want to congratulate them. And Tony C. And Tony C. was actually inducted into the first class posthumously, so I think that's a beautiful memory and a wonderful tribute to him. But this year, if you have anyone you want to nominate, there will be a nominating form online, and we ask you to think about it. It's a great way for people to come back to St. Mary's. It's a terrific way to honor our athletic legacy, and I think all of you are probably pretty proud of the athletic legacy at St. Mary's and the great student-athletes that we produce. You know, this year we won our first hockey championship in 30 years. So Mark Lee and his team won the state championship. And that was such a great feat. And we've had state championships for the past, I think, 12 years. So congratulations to you. And thank you for your commitment to St. Mary's. And thank you to this esteemed group of gentlemen for sharing their history and their love of St. Mary's, and I hope that you come over and visit us, and we're really excited to have you here tonight. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Grace. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn it over to tonight's moderator, the publisher of the Essex Media Group and the Daily Item, a proud member of the St. Mary's High School class of 1972, Ted Grant. Ted?
We all know the stories. Tony Conigliaro was the youngest player to hit 100 home runs. He hit a home run on his first pitch at Fenway Park. He hit a home run in his first game back in 1969, two seasons after the beating. But Tommy Arabino, Frank Carey, and Tony Nicosia know the stories we don't know. They were as close to Tony as anybody. They were his St. Mary's high school teammates. They were his pallbearers. Frank, talk about Tony as a minor leaguer.
First of all, oh, it's working okay. Thank you for introducing me, and also I want to thank everybody that's here on behalf of Tony's memory. He was obviously quite a player and quite a friend of all of ours here in Lynn. Real quick, I think it's appropriate that you give me the statistics end of it, because my two teammates are not very good in math. So what I will do is give you a few statistics.
And he is.
On Tony C. At 18 years old, Tony was, again, the statistics tell the truth, but at 18 years old, he hit 24 home runs at Wellsville. He batted 363. And regarding the stats, if you were to take his rookie season, his minor league season, add it to his first three seasons in Major League Baseball, He had a total of 106 home runs that were hit. And to put it in perspective, in the late 1990, as the director of the high school all-star game at Fenway Park, we played Connecticut, and one of our players in Massachusetts was Rick Assadurian, the number one draft pick for the Boston Red Sox. And they compared him very favorably in the papers to Tony Conigliano. And being a teammate and knowing the history of Tony, I knew different. And I said to Rick as we stood on the dugout steps, I said, "You see that left field wall over there, Rick?" He says, "Yeah, I do." Now, Rick was 19. I says, by the time Tony C was 19, he had already hit first 24 and 36. He had hit 60 home runs over that wall at your age. I'm not sure you can do that today. And he kind of realized that maybe the comparison to Tony C wasn't for real. But in regards to those statistics, again, I can just say this, that I did a little bit of some math, advanced math. I added up all of his home runs, which the first 5 years totaled 106. However, he had missed almost a total of 160 games, which is a full season. So if you were to do the math, 106 divided by 4 was whatever. It was 26 or 7.
It was a bunch.
And I think there was Rick McNair just wrote a recent article projecting him to have hit, he would have been, if he continued on the path, he was actually averaging a little bit over 30 home runs in this short period of time. He estimated that he would be the highest, the most home runs hit in Boston Red Sox history. It would have been in the high 500. So that's, it's quite a compliment to Tony. It's kind of quite a compliment to his power. And real quick, I'll just say this. As a hitter, we all know in high school, dead right center field hitter. As a professional player, primarily a pull hitter, told players on my high school team, that was his hitting strategy. In high school, he knew enough to hit the ball away, and he stood off the plate. He was 6'3". In the pros, he knew enough to get on the plate. He challenged pitches to pitch him inside because he became a pull hitter, and that was somewhat part of his demise, but also part of his history as well.
Tony, talk about Tony's relationship with his Red Sox manager, Swampscott, neighbor, and his biggest proponent, John Fesky.
Yeah, but first I'd like to comment on Frank on Tommy and I being mathematicians. We didn't have to be math wizards to figure out your batting average, by the way. Johnny Pesky. Johnny Pesky was just a wonderful person, anyone that knew him. But he also had tremendous foresight in looking at talent. And Tony was a skinny kid, and he would work and work and work. And having moved in the area, he saw his work ethic. And I'm looking out here amongst the group here, and there's many guys that played football and basketball and baseball teammates here. And they will attest that he would be squeezing a ball, vice grips, anything to strengthen his wrist and hand. And Johnny saw that, and Johnny would see how he would work. And based on his first year, which were incredible, in that season, 24 home runs in a short span at Wellsville, there was an opening. And one of the outfielders got hurt, and he pledged to the family that I'm going to try and do everything I can to get you there. And he was, the roadblocks were set upon him. And finally he was able to get him down to spring training. And of course the story, you know, prevailed from there on in. He was just a wonderful guy and recognized the talent and hard work that Tony would put into it.
Tommy, speaking of Pesky, tell us about the Pesky guy, Tony, and the red Corvette at Beacon Chevrolet.
I shall. And thank you for getting to me, Ted. I want to get a couple in before you get back to Frank. And again, nice to see all the former teammates that are here, friends, and associates of Tony's that we have a lot of stories, obviously, but there's guys sitting right here that have just as many and were just as close to Tony. The Pesky guy story is I was Tony's straight man after high school. I didn't really catch up with Tony beyond being a teammate until I lost my senior year in 1961, came back in 62, and became a senior with Tony and some of these guys sitting right here. And I never hung around with Tony socially prior to that point in time. And there's guys in this room that are even closer to him, Mike Kavanaugh, very close friend of Tony, all through high school. But as we got into our senior year, playing three sports together, spring football, American Legion baseball during the summer, post six. So I was literally with Tony for a year. Many nights he slept over my house rather than drive back to East Boston and became close to my parents. So that thing evolved, and as time went on, we became closer. So I became his straight guy, as I started to say. So shortly after he started making some money, they had moved to Swampscott, and he had always had a dream he liked fast cars, of having a red Corvette. He calls me one morning, and he says, "You doing anything?" "No, why?" He says, "Take a ride with me. I'm going to get on Beacon Chevrolet. I want to look at, and I want to buy a Corvette." I said, "Yeah, I'll go by. Pick me up." He comes by, picks me up in his 56 Chevy, orange and lime yellow, awful car. So we're down to Beacon Chevrolet. We go, and those of you who are from Lynn might remember, it was kind of a narrow plot of land, and it had a narrow building. And you pull into the driveway, and you almost go right up to the doors of the showroom. So we get out of the car, and I remember it so vivid. We both had on our post-6 American Legion jackets, which we got annually when the season ended. You got a post-6 jacket. We still had them on, probably chinos. And we go into the showroom, and there was three cars in the showroom. There was a Bel Air, there was an Impala, and there was a Corvette. And it was red, and it was a convertible, beautiful nylon black top. So we walk in, salesman paying no attention to us. Finally, Tony kind of gets the guy's attention. Guy comes up, "Can I help you guys?" He said, "Yeah, you know, how much is this red Corvette?" He says, come on. "I don't have time for this." He says, "What do you mean? We don't want to talk about another car. This is a very expensive car." He says, I want to buy the car." He says, no. He says, "Look, I'm one of Pesky's boys." He goes, "What? I'm one of Pesky's boys. Who are you?" He says, "Never mind." "Where are we going, Tony?" "There's another Chevrolet deal on Eastern Avenue in Malden, right across from the car wash." I said, "Where are we going? What are you doing?" Right, zoom, over to Eastern Avenue, Malden. I forget the name of the dealership. I want to say Myra. And we go, and again, there's a Corvette. It wasn't red at the time. They had one in the ad. And the salesman was very gracious. "How can I help you guys?" Tony said, "I'm interested in Corvette. How much is it? Blah, 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 blah. I'll buy it." Long story short, a couple days later, go back, pick up the car with his 56 Chevrolet to trade in, put the plates on, heading back to Lynn. Coming down the Lindway, we're going to head towards Swampscott. He starts to pull into Beacon Chevrolet. I said, "Where you going?" "Well, don't start, Tony. What are you doing?" Pulls in the driveway, pulls the brand new Corvette right up to the double doors, going to show. "Tony, come on, cut it." "Yeah, no." And he gets out of the car, and he's waving. I said, "What are you doing?" Trying to get the sale. Find the salesman lifts. He goes, "One of Pesky's boys." True story.
Tony's teammates, Mike Anders and George Scott, thought Tony was a great clutch hitter. Talk about it.
Yeah, really. Many, many years ago, Mike Andrews and I happened to be doing a clinic, and Mike was playing second, I was playing short. And after the clinic, we went out for a few libations and something to eat, and Tony's name came up. And he turned to me in a very solemn way, and he said, "He is positively the second best clutch hitter I've ever seen." Well, it really, you know, I was taken back by it, really. I said, "Really, that's quite a thing with all the ball players you saw." So I said, "Well, who was the first that the best you ever saw?" And he said, "Dick Allen." Now, some of you may remember it. Dick Allen was a great, great player for Philadelphia, and then he got traded to the White Sox. And Mike Andrews happened to get traded to the White Sox and play with him for a while. which I thought was a tremendous compliment because Dick Allen, of course, he swung that 40-ounce bat and home runs and was a manager's nightmare, but the players loved him. And then, lo and behold, years later, my son was playing baseball for the Massachusetts Mad Dogs, and George Scott was the manager. Now, George Scott and Tony were great, great buddies. They played at Wellsville together. Tony has told us many stories, some we could tell, some we can't. But anyway, Tony told him that partway in the season that I was a friend of his and whatnot. He called me down at a practice. And out of the blue, he said to me, Tony was the second best clutch hitter I've ever seen. And I said, really, who was number one to you? And he said, for all of us that follow baseball, Frank Robinson. And I thought that was a great testimony. I mean, can you imagine Tony being up there with Dick Allen and Frank Robinson? He said to me that if the game was on the line, Tony would fight to get to the bat rack. That's how much he wanted to get up to hit. So, again, that's just another attribute of Tony that a lot of people don't know. He had that desire to succeed at all times.
Tom, Tony was a star athlete. Obviously, he was good looking. Word was, he was a fat. What do you think?
So, let's kill it. Let's kill it right now. Guys in this room, test. Tony Conigliaro was cocky. He was self-assured. He would tell you, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do against this guy. This is what I'm going to do against this team. But he would never tell you about it afterwards. He was not a fathead. He was sure of himself. He was destined. He knew it. He worked hard. He practiced hard every single day. He played hard every single day. Games, football, basketball, baseball. A lot of guys with his talent as baseball players, like Danny Murphy, bonus baby from St. John's Prep, okay, wouldn't play football. Tony Conigliaro played football both ways, quarterback, defensive back, hit, scurried, ran. So this business of him being a fathead, some of that stuff emanates from people that were jealous of him, that didn't know him. The guys in this room knew him. He was a funny kid. He was a cocky kid. He just full of life. And he loved to play, but he was not. He was never a fathead because he didn't brag. He just told you what he was going to do, and he did it.
Now, from what I understand, if Conigliaro did show signs of being a fathead, Tommy had a way of shutting him down. I've been told that early on, your name carried more clout in Yankee Stadium than his did. Talk about that.
As things would have it, when I get to the end of this story, you'll get the picture. So early in 1967, before Tony got hit, he had a Red Sox had a game at Yankee Stadium. He hits a line single, takes the turn at first base, comes back to first base in the lull, and the first baseman, you often see a first baseman talking to an opponent, making small talk in between pitches or waiting for the lull to occur. The first baseman says to him, how's Tommy, Tony? And Tony tells me the story, and he reacted, how's Tommy Arabino? He goes, good, I guess. So in between innings, he goes into the Red Sox dugout. He says to this guy, who the hell's that first baseman? That's Hegan. Who's Hegan? That's Mike Hegan. He doesn't know. So he goes back from the road trip. Of course, he's got to call me. He says, I can't shake you. I'm in Yankee Stadium. And this guy, so I tell him the story. Mike Hegan, all right, son of Jim Hegan, Lynn English, born and brought up in Lynn, played for the Eastern Little League Giants. And by the way, somebody recently wrote a book in Lynn about the Little League City Series history. Well, the Eastland Giants won the first three City Series with Mike Hegan and a few others, Brother Joe and others. And then Mike stayed in Lynn, and we had what's called the Park Pony League. And it was Kylie Park, Memorial, Fry, Barry Park, Magnolia. Mike Hegan played with us again on the Kylie Park team. We were close friends and stayed friends all through high school. He moved to Cleveland, and went to St. Ignatius High School in Cleveland and ended up going to Holy Cross. I remained very close friends with him all those summers. And so I explained this to Tony. I said, Tony, you don't even know this guy. I just got to figure out a way how to shake you. I go to Yankee Stadium, and I got to hear your goddamn name.
Frank, Tony, it said, took his conditioning seriously, and alcohol wasn't a part of that. Talk about that.
No, I definitely can attest to that, because I used to hear people talk about Tony and partying. Yes, I'm not denying that. Tony and the girlfriends, yes. But as far as the drinking, you know, and the times I was with him, I can honestly say I don't ever remember even seeing him drink. I can give you examples. He would come down, unlike my other friends from Lynn that would visit me at the University of Rhode Island underage for a certain reason. Tony came down to visit me, not for that, but he wanted to meet some of the prettiest girls on the campus, which...
And like you knew them.
Well...
Here we go.
Okay, we're going to start now.
I was there too, Frank.
So my point is that certainly he didn't display any of that. In 1978, I went out to San Francisco for a baseball conference, and incidentally, while out there, Tony C's picture was on the front page of some parade magazine as the most eligible bachelor in all of the San Francisco, Oakland area. I had contacted him ahead of time to tell him I was coming out there. He, in turn, invited me to his home in Sausalito. It's a suburb of Oakland, San Francisco. And it was a big party going on that evening. And again, once again, there was all kinds of people and doing whatever they do. And Tony wasn't drinking. Tony didn't drink. But I did, I will say this. On the wall, there was a photo. And it's probably the only piece of memorabilia that I saw. And it was kind of interesting because it was McCoy Stadium. And that's the AAA ballpark of the Boston Red Sox. So I went out to see Tony, and I said, Tony, you know, with all your accolades, what's with the McCoy Stadium? And he remembered it. He wanted it to be a reminder to him as the 75 season, which we'll talk about a little later, as he made his second or third comeback. When he finally got released, they sent him eventually to Pawtucket, AAA, and he wanted it. He used that as a reminder that how hard and how difficult it was, even though he moved right into the major leagues. But it was a source of inspiration for him. So, but to get to the point, I've never known Tony to be, unlike some of my other Lynn friends out here, he never participated in that.
Why are you looking at me? Tommy, you have a memory of a Christmas morning phone call from Tony asking you go to hear a couple of songs.
It gets to the point that I can't shake this guy, okay? So, and I, the years are all running together for me here, but so I was still living at home on Autumn Street, so I obviously wasn't married. One Christmas morning, get a phone call. It's probably 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. The presents are all done. Ricky's probably putting his fire truck together. I think Joe was married. The grandparents, Emilio, hadn't shown up yet. Tony calls. He says, hey, what are you doing? I said, what do you mean, Monday? It's Christmas. What do you think I'm doing? Why? He said, you got to come over. You got to come over. Now, he lived now on Parsons Drive in Swampscott, right off of Paradise. I said, not 5 miles. I said, why? What do you want? He said, you got to hear. I'm doing a record. You got to hear it. I said, put it on. I'm on the phone. No, come on, don't fool around. Come on over. All right. So I go over, and I walk in the house, beautiful, beautiful big kitchen, and they're all sitting around the table. Sal, Teresa, Billy, and Rotten Richard. And they get these big grins on, grinning, because they know that when I come in, I'm going to be breaking them pretty good on old Tony boy, right? So Howdy comes, he's got the 45 record player, and he puts this little single disc on, and this music starts, and all I could hear was the background singers, like Elvis Presley's guys behind him singing, and this scratchy voice, something about a little red scooter, and he's laughing. He's laughing. I said, are you serious? He said, well, teenagers are going to go, they're going to, I said, you know what? Freddie Cannon is safe. And I ended up having some nice stuffed artichokes that Teresa made anyways. And I just laughed, and they laughed it too, because they knew what I was going to do.
Tony, what do you remember about Little Red Scooter and playing the field?
Well, there was a time when Tommy wasn't with us at a particular time. We got a call to play a game. Lynn Jets, we were a baseball team, and we got a chance to play in Connecticut, and the game got canceled. And a lot of people don't know this, but Tony bought a nightclub down the Cape. And we decided we'd tell our girlfriends that we're going to Connecticut, and we went down the Cape. All right. So we went to his club, and after being at this hotel throughout the day, and you paid a cover charge. He didn't have a full alcoholic license yet. And we went in and we were partying and they had a band going, and all of a sudden in walks Tony about 11 o'clock and he saw us. And to tell you the truth, Frank and I and Buddy Papagallis and several other guys, Richie Wantsworth and on, he couldn't believe it. And we convinced him to go up and sing his songs. Well, when he came back, he goes, what do you think? And Buddy Papagallis, whoever knows him here, very frank. He looked at him, he said, it stinks, you know. Well, he said, you know, I made $4,000 with that. Pappy said again, it stinks. And we had a few laughs. But then the funny part of this story is, we said, as we walked into his club, there was a guy with a giant camera about 4 feet long, you know, back in the mid-60s. And we said, what is this? And then it continued on through the night. And then when Tony was sitting with us, he said, what do you got, home movies, Tony? He said, no, this is Channel 4, 11 o'clock. They're doing a big spread tomorrow night. And Frank and I looked and we said, no, you know, this can't be. So actually, I think Jerry Waldron's teammate of Tony and us, his brother Joe, had a place down the Cape. And we went over to his place the next night for the news section party going on. We had the black and white hexagon TV with the patent coming on. And it said, now from Tony C's grand opening, and the first scene is Frank Carey twisted away. You know, chubby checker out there. He looked at it and went down on his knees. And then to tell you how screwy we were in those days, the next day we're at the hotel and we put our uniforms on. No game had ensued during the weekend. And all of a sudden we're out there in the dirt and the grass doing backdoor slides, pop-up slides, head-first slides. We got to come home with a dirty uniform because no one would believe we didn't play. You know, and the people in the motel or hotel were looking at, what are these strange dudes doing out there? But that was our thing with Tony in the song. But I actually brought a picture of Tony on a 45, and he did a great job, obviously. Thank you.
Tommy, what about the Surf Nightclub in Revere and Mudcat Grant? And for the record, I don't think Mudcat and I are related.
Okay, again, the phone call to the straight man. And I believe this was a Saturday when the Red Sox had an afternoon game. I get a call, I'm pretty sure it was from Tony. He says, hey, can you get some of the guys together? For what? I'm singing tonight at the Surf. Surf what? Surf theaters in Swampscott. That's a movie theater. No, the nightclub. Seriously, what do you want? Can you get some of the guys and come? I said, why? Well, Mudcat Grant is the featured singer. And he said, I'm going to be like the second part of the show. I said, why would you think that I would get people to go look at that? Don't fool around. So I called these guys and maybe a few guys in this room right now. So we bring a couple of carloads over to Surf Nightclub. and Revere Beach. And there's a name up on the thing, Mudcat Grant, no Tony C. So we go in, he sees, he's all happy, he comes over, says hi to everybody. And Mudcat Grant got up, and there was a bunch of teeny boppers in there, you know, the girls with the high hair and stuff. And so Mudcat Grant was pretty good. I mean, this guy could sing, he was very smooth. And then they put on the Joker. And he gets up and he starts the rendition. It may have been the second one you talked about. And I think Papageles was part of that crowd too. Not a good story for Tony. So the more we sang, the more we started laughing. We did everything but throw bottles at him. And finally, he breaks down laughing and walks off the stage.
Frank, what's the deal with former Red Sox reliever Dick Raddatz in the case of beer?
Okay, I know that's part of the script. I'm going to break the script for a second. The administrators at St. Mary's would appreciate this, Mr. Ridley and Ms. Carter Reagan. Back in high school, there was three guys that used to sing in the schoolyard. Tony C, Joe Arabino, both had terrific voices in the interloper me. And we would sing in the schoolyard, and kids, it might have been Mike Cav, and these guys would throw nickels, dimes, quarters, and throw money at us for our performance. Well, the principal that day bagged, I was the lead singer. No, actually, I wasn't. She bagged me, brought me to the office, and was very upset at our actions because we had quite a crowd out there. And I managed to get out of it by simply telling her the money that we raised was for the Bishop's Relief Fund, which we're donating to that school. So I thought I'd just add that in, but that's how Tony got started.
That's a good one.
But getting back to the Dick Raddatz story, Tony come down with a bunch of the Red Sox. In those days, they used to try to, a moonlight, making some money on the side. And they had a basketball team of Red Sox players, and it made up of Bill Mombouquette, Kyle Yastrzemski, Dick Raddatz, and Tony C, and a couple of other, Chet Nichols, you wouldn't remember them. But anyways, they come down to URI or Kingston, Rhode Island to play. I had contacted Tony. I said, hey, I'm going to be down here. I'm going to see you at the game. We can get together, so forth and so on. I told Raddatz his story, who I had the pleasure of working with the North Shore Spirit. He was a terrific, funny guy. I told Dick the story about how I could see his head above all the lockers. Now, he played at Michigan State, and of course, Tony played at St. Mary's High School, and they were probably the two best players. But I said, Tony told me this story. You verify it. Tony meets me in the locker room, and he's amazed. He says, Frank, you won't believe it. He said, I come down in the car with Yaz, Mambo, the monster, and me. He said, there was a case of beer in the car. Raddatz drank it all by himself. And I asked Dick that story, and he confirmed it. He goes, yeah, he said, I did. He says, that Tony, he said, he was a lightweight. But it turned out they were the best two players, and it was a few laughs that night.
Tony, tell us what you remember about Tony, by then an established star with the Sox, playing in an exhibition game at Fraser Field for the Jimmy Fund.
Yeah, I remember it well. Actually, when you look back at it, it was an amazing thing. The Red Sox organization allowed him to come down and play against the Lynn Jets for a Jimmy Fund game. Fraser Field was packed, and they weren't there to see Frank, that's for sure. And it was just an amazing thing. He showed up, and like all of us, you know, we've been together since before high school. We've known each other and hung around, and we have to be thick-skinned to hang around with each other. I mean, we're brutal to each other. Well, it was the same way when Tony showed up. Here he is, removed from us, professional athlete. First inning, he's up, and he's got two strikes on him, and we had a pitcher, Richie Wantrich, who these guys will know. He really, really turned into a hell of a pitcher. He threw him one of the best hard knucklers. It wasn't a floater, and he had him mesmerized. And actually, the umpire was ready to call him out, strike three. And he started yelling at Richie, throw a fastball, throw a fastball. Of course, now we pick up on it, and we're all over him. Hey, what do you think you're hitting in that popcorn league? Get in there, you know. And, of course, he's infuriated. Well, lo and behold, he grounds out to me, and I throw him out. Three innings later, I will say this. I know Frank doesn't like to hear it. I led off with a triple, and I thought I was going to get a home run before the fence was put up there. And I'm rounding third, and they're holding up, and a laser came in from right field. It was Tony's throw. Tony had a good arm in high school, but major league arm, he was really, really improved. So then the second time up, he hit a hard ground ball foul, and lo and behold, he grounded out to me again. And so the two times at bat, he hit two ground balls to me and got in his Cadillac, or the car that the limo brought him into the game in right field, and took him away. But if you really think about it, it would be similar to having Vienna Tendi allowed to play in Lynn against some local team. Incredible that the Sox did it, but we raised some money for the Jimmy Fund, and it was a great night, really.
Tom, talk about the time you and your wife Ruthie and Tony's date attended a game at Fenway.
Again, the pratfall guy here. So I was not married again. Ruth and I were going together quite a while. He calls one day. Sal and Teresa couldn't make a game. They didn't miss many in the family. And Tony says, hey, you and Ruth want to come in the game tonight. I got a date, and we'll go out. There was a place at the end of Lynn Marsh Road. There's a big road here called Senior Pizza. Right? I said, well, we'll be happy to do that. So in we go. He says, you know, the family seats, and they're kind of like 20 rows up in the grandstand under the roof behind the Red Sox dugout. So we go, and we get introduced to this young lady, and I sat on the end of the row, and all's well, watch the game. Sometime around the sixth inning, there's an usher starting to walk up, slowly looking, and it says, is there a Tom Arabino here? Uh-oh, here we go. I can't imagine what this is going to be. So, yeah, that's me, he says. In between this inning, they're out in the field, the Red Sox are out in the field. In between this inning, Tony would like to see you down by the clubhouse, down, knock on the clubhouse door. I go, what? He goes, yeah, he'd like to. Now, the date goes, same thing I'm thinking, here we go. I have no idea what this man wants. So the inning ends, he's running in from right field, and he lasers, I got the meatball eyes on me, lasering me with the expression. I go, yeah, I got the message, I'll be down, no idea. I get out in the clubhouse, knock on the door, a policeman opens the door, you Tom? Yeah, step in, and there he is. 6'3", big grin, the meatball eyes are beaming. He goes, hey, you gotta do me a favor. I said, don't stop. What? He said, can you take Helen home with you? She lives in Revere. I said, Tony, I'm telling you right now, cut it out. Don't stop. I'm not going there with you. And I didn't use very nice language. Okay. No, goes. Come on, don't fool him. I said, what am I going to tell her? What are you doing? What's going on? Tell her that Pesky wants me to go speak after the game. I said, you speak? And I said, it's going to be 10 o'clock? Who are you going to speak to? You're going to Tony's bar? He goes, no, come on, cut it out. Don't fool around. Tell him I got to do autographs. I got something that I said, okay, I'm going to do this for you, but there's going to be payback. I go back to the seats, and the girl goes, what's the story? And I said, well, you know, Mr. Pesky's got into a jackpot, and somebody canceled him. He needs Tony to sign autographs. So she goes, boy, that's a whopper. So Ruth and I drive her home. She lived right near Paul Revere Stadium. Not a word was said all the way home. I thought my wife, okay. I called him the next day. I said, don't you ever. And he just laughed. He thought it was the funniest thing he ever did. Nice friend, the Pratt guy.